and welcome to the latest edition of the RevDem Rule of Law podcast. My name is Oliver Garner. It is a pleasure to be joined in person in London today by the co-director of the CEU Democracy Institute and co-editor-in-chief of RevDem, Professor Renato Uitz. In addition to these roles, Renato is a professor in the CEU Department of Legal Studies, a co-principal investigator in a Volkswagen Stiftung research network on historical analysis in comparative and transnational perspectives on illiberal constitutionalism in East Central Europe, and co-principal investigator of the Jean Monnet Network on Brexit research and interchange on differentiated governance in Europe. The Bridge Network is hosting an event at the Court of Justice in Luxembourg, considering the rule of law crisis and supremacy of EU law, which will be the topic of our conversation today. So thank you very much for joining us, Renato.
Thank you for having me.
On the 27th of January, the Bridge Network held a conference on the rule of law crisis and the future of EU governance. And on 13th of May, there is the event on the rule of law crisis and the supremacy of EU law in Luxembourg, as mentioned in our introduction. In the meantime, we have seen Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the re-election of Viktor Orban in Hungary, and his subsequent resistance to EU energy sanctions plans. But focusing on this topic of primacy of EU law and the Court of Justice, in a RevDem podcast in March, Anna Bobic, a referendaire at the Court of Justice, argued that the primacy of EU law is only affected by the rule of law crisis by extension. Would you agree with her position that if any of the attacks on the rule of law did not focus on primacy at all, we would still have the same rule of law crisis? Or do you think instead that resistance to the idea of a supreme authority beyond the nation states, such as the Court of Justice and other EU institutions, is a core tenet of the Polish and Hungarian government's projects of a liberalism?
I certainly think that the rule of law crisis forced both EU institutions and the member states to rethinking basic premises of how the EU legal order works. And what I think is most important about recent attacks on primacy is that it's not simply driven by courts, including very eminent courts like the German Constitutional Court, but also that attacks on primacy now entered into a political dialogue, a high political dialogue, where prime ministers and MEPs start to discuss in very heated terms the very basic premises of EU law. Now, this created a space for the Court of Justice to actually restate foundational questions about what makes the EU legal order work and what is the position of the court vis-a-vis member states and also vis-a-vis national courts within this space. I doubt that this was calculated by the liberal member states that their rule of law shenanigans will lead to this point. And however, I'd argue that it has to do with the deferential approach of the Commission, its lack of willingness to engage, and the endless dialogue in which political and legal elements merge that led the rule of law crisis to finally be able to touch such basic premises as primacy and the role of the court within the Court of Justice within the legal order. So it might be that is by extension that we've gotten here, but now it definitely falls on the court to sort out some of the basics, and I think the court is doing a brilliant job in this respect.
Well, it's very interesting to hear your analysis there of how actually it may well have become a more salient political issue, and you said about the fact it's fallen on the court to sort these issues out, and we've seen that the court has become a lead player in addressing the reforms to the judiciary that have been happening, especially in Poland, through its judgments on Article 19 of the Treaty on the European Union on effective legal protection. And on this topic of the interplay between political will and judicial action, Carlo Tuori, I think in his book in 2015, argued that the Court of Justice's juridical constitutionalism in the 1960s and 70s on internal market norms was driven by the necessity to fill the vacuum caused by the empty seat crisis, where President de Gaulle of France was not turning up to the EU institutions. So do you think that the court has been similarly prompted by political inertia, as you mentioned in the Commission and also the Council, during this crisis?
Well, I certainly think that there is very solid basis to read the jurisprudence of the court in the last decade in these terms. I am not privy to what President Lennart is thinking, but I do believe that the court also looked at the treaties and followed very carefully how the application of Article 7 unfolds. I mean, Article 7 was meant to be a preventive mechanism. Very little prevention has happened. And in the early years, when prevention was the name of the game, the court spent a fair bit of time trying to point out the risks to judicial independence, particular measures posed. The court was also very careful to talk about the chilling effect of particular national state measures on political participatory rights. And it has only been recently, after a fairly long waiting period, that the court started to confirm the significance, the constitutional significance of pre-commitment to obligations in the founding treaties. The condition, the court is starting to become extremely proactive in forcing governments, especially Hungary and Poland, to give the true reasons for justifying particular legal measures, especially restrictions on free, of the basic fundamental freedoms under the treaties, forcing the terms of constitutional dialogue to be honest and in the form of a reasoned debate. So I will argue at the next bridge event at the court, that the court is essentially re-establishing the epistemological foundations of the European constitutional order and is making a very important contribution to hold all players, EU institutions as well as to the member states, to the premises of Article 2 values. Because ultimately the EU doesn't work if its members are not functioning constitutional democracies.
You mentioned the role of the court not only in relation to the member states and rule of law and other democratic principles, but also the EU institutions. And a follow-up question I had to my last question concerns the European Parliament, which I think can probably be distinguished from the Commission and the Council because of the fact it has been very active in its response to the rule of law crisis. We've seen, for example, that the budget conditionality regulation originated as proposals in the Parliament in 2018. So how do you see the relationship between the European Parliament and the Court of Justice in addressing the crisis, if indeed there is
one? Well, I believe that there is one, and I believe that when we are talking about the epistemological foundations of the constitutional order, the European Parliament has a very important role and may even have inspired the rather long conditional judgment of the Court of Justice. The Parliament, throughout the crisis, has been exemplary in trying to put the bits and pieces of the legal record, the judgment here, the Venice Commission opinion there, to build a story and to be able to narrate in a compelling manner what was at stake in the rule of law crisis, how particular seemingly unrelated measures actually resulted in undermining the founding values of the Union. So this narrative function, or narrating function of the Parliament is crucial because it was Liwe, it was various MEPs who were doing particular reports, who were trying to explain the rule of law crisis, both the role of the institutions and the shenanigans of the member states in terms that became reportable by the press for a broader European audience. And frankly, I think that this is possible because you have a new generation of MEPs, especially from these liberal member states, who come from the opposition side of politics domestically. And especially in the case of Hungary, opposition rights are extremely curtailed, and this falls upon the MEPs to make up for the deficiencies of parliamentary scrutiny functions and inquiry functions on the national level using the procedures of the European Parliament. So I definitely see the court and parliament as complementary, and the court is creating the legal foundations, while parliament has an extremely important storytelling and coherence building function here.
No, I find that fascinating to think of. Yeah, this idea of resolutions and proposals as a form of narration, and I suppose an advantage that the European Parliament has when compared to the court, not only the direct democratic legitimacy of elections, but I suppose also the freedom to act proactively rather than as the court is obviously tied to reacting to infringements being brought. So it'll be very interesting to track how that relationship progresses, and perhaps if we see challenges to the budget conditionality regulation. You mentioned in an answer a few questions ago that obviously you're not privy to the internal workings of the court and President Lennart, but we have been fortunate enough to hear speeches by President Koen Lennart at both the Reconnect final conference last month and also at the European Central Bank. And in these speeches, the President discussed the budget conditionality regulation judgment from February of the Court of Justice. And he outlined in more depth the position that the values found in Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union constitute the identity of the EU, as the court stated in its dicta. He stated further that this identity cannot be overridden by constitutional identity claims formulated by member states. As these values in Article 2 are so broadly formulated and could arguably be regarded as deriving from the constitutional orders of all the member states when it comes to things like liberty and democracy, do you think this claim that these values are the constitutional identity of the Union and should be regulated by the courts could be portrayed as a competence expansion by the court? And do you think this could maybe intensify supremacy clashes in the future?
Well, I believe that, and here I'm not going to do more than direct everyone's full attention to a provocative article from a few years ago by Federico Fabbrini and Andrea Shio, because I share their concerns about national constitutional identity and the stealthy sovereignty claims in them to play out. And what I also believe is that what the Court of Justice has been doing recently is not expanding its role, but claiming the territory of a court in the middle of the rule of law crisis.
Yes.
On the fringes of the rule of law crisis, if you wish. So I wouldn't talk about expansion. In terms of whether the clash is intensified, a lot depends on how national constitutional courts react.
Yeah.
I think that especially at the ECB conference, President Lennart's speech about proportionality and the role of the court and both national legislatures and national courts in proportionality analysis is really enlightening. My major concern here is that the more we expect a sovereignty and supremacy clash on the EU level, scholars especially will be likely to narrate national constitutional court judgments in terms of, you know, this was yet another opportunity that this national constitutional court could have made a strong identity or sovereignty claim, and they didn't do that.
Mm.
And I would warn against doing that, because if we scholars start to tell the story of interaction between the CJEU and the National Constitutional Court in terms of this national court again didn't use the opportunity to invoke national constitutional identity, we will actually undermine the efforts of the Court of Justice to solidify and consolidate the EU legal order and to restate its premises in terms of Article 2 values.
Mm. I can see a risk, the picture you painted there of us almost congratulating constitutional court judgments if they don't override supremacy of EU law. I can see a comparison here to the political veto power that is being exercised, or at least threatened, as we discussed at the start, by Viktor Orban on energy sanctions and as we've seen throughout European integration. So indeed, perhaps the risk of expanding in the idea of national constitutional identity is that we make constitutional courts another veto player rather than a dialogic partner.
I think the fear really is that if you go down this path, then the mark of good EU citizenship will be not vetoing political action and not questioning the primacy of EU law when it comes to legal conflict. And it's not simply standing in the way of further integration, but ultimately when not vetoing measures is the new mark of cooperation that is going to undermine the operation of the single market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the topic of further integration. A further important event we've seen in the last weeks has been the conclusion of the Conference on the Future of Europe. And the proposals formulated by the Citizens Panel on Values and Rights, Rule of Law and Security advocate for an annual Rule of Law Conference with citizen participation. They also make further proposals for the universal applicability of the Charter of Fundamental Rights. And also they argue for the consideration of extension of the conditionality regulation to new areas, regardless of their relevance for the EU budget. Do you think that such proposals would help address the crisis? And finally, might the focus on deliberative democratic mechanisms, such as rule of law conferences, sideline or complement the role of the Court of Justice?
Deliberative democratic mechanisms work in the political sphere, and the Court of Justice's primary job is within the legal order of the European Union. The reason why I am not too enthusiastic about further annual peer-to-peer navel gazing under the label of the rule of law is very well summed up in the report which Laurent Pesch and Petra Bayer did for the European Parliament on the Commission on the annual review mechanism. My problem is not that this treats good member states and bad member states on par with each other, but rather the use of euphemistic language really risks undermining the whole point of the exercise, which is safeguarding the Union's founding values from the types of member state acts and actions that put the Union as a whole on a slippery slope of democratic and rule of law backsliding. To do this exercise on a larger scale in a participatory manner is not going to help anyone, including civil society organizations that are advocating to hold member states accountable for violating the founding values, quite the opposite. We risk even further sliding into irrelevance. And that's the, compared to that, just having an annual gathering and a really nice party where people are comparing notes over good food is already a good outcome, but probably this is not the best way of creating deliberative democratic mechanisms in the EU. I mean, after all, deliberative democracy has more to it than mere participation. If it doesn't come with an accountability component, then deliberation is inconsequential, both politically and in legal terms.
Well, the recommendations from the conference presented to the European Parliament also did allude to the possibility of treaty reform to further bolster the EU's rule of law toolkit, as it were. So perhaps if the European Parliament gets its way and we have a treaty revision under Article 48, there could be a chance to consider from first principles how to address values and rule of law backsliding. Thank you so much, Renata, for your participation in the podcast today. And I'd encourage our listeners to follow RevDem on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and Facebook for further content and debate on these topics. Thank you, Renata.
Thank you.